Welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast. My name's Phil Topham, Executive Director of the FIEC. And with me this morning are John Stevens, our National Director. Hello, John.
Hi, Phil.
And Adrian Reynolds, our Head of National Ministries. Hello, Adrian.
Welcome to spring.
Welcome to spring.
It has sprung.
It has sprung. It feels a little warmer.
Clock's going forward.
Well, that's this weekend, isn't it? So, don't be late for church by an hour. There's always one family that does it, I think, in every church.
It's okay, as long as the preacher doesn't. That's the main one.
Well, it's time for our look at the news. This is In the News, when we look at the main news stories of the last couple of weeks. And I want us to start with the Metropolitan Police. So Baroness Casey's report came out this week, where she labelled the Met Police institutionally racist, misogynistic, homophobic. She said they can't be in denial about the deep-rooted issues at the heart of the Metropolitan Police. An absolutely excoriating report from Baroness Casey. And it does, I think, further undermine trust in the police, doesn't it? That's got to be what it does, first and foremost.
Well, I think inevitably, it is a shocking report in terms of what's been exposed in terms of the sort of systemic racism, misogyny, homophobia. It's even more shocking that 24 years ago, the McPherson report exposed the institutional racism of the Metropolitan Police. And therefore, kind of at one level, the question arises, why has not that not been dealt with? Why has that not been kind of addressed? And inevitably, it undermines trust. But at one level, it probably exposes a reality that many people thought was the case anyway. So it highlights the way the black community in London have been badly treated by the police.
Over-policed, they said, didn't they?
Yeah, I think in many ways the black community would recognise that. So it's in a sense, the trust had already been lost. And so simply exposing the reality, the same is true in relation to violence against women and domestic abuse, rape victims in London. Many women in London feel the police have not served their interests. So you might be right that it does undermine trust in the police. But I think amongst the constituencies, that trust had already been lost because of the way the police had behaved. And therefore, the report perhaps opens an opportunity for those issues to be addressed and to be resolved and to bring them to the attention of the Met. But there's no denying that they expose a culture of abuse, failure, choosing of priorities that disadvantage some groups and not others. And it has been absolutely shocking. And it again reveals the sort of the relationship between kind of individual wrongdoing and cultural and institutional kind of wrongdoing. Because obviously there are multiple stories of the way that sort of individuals have behaved towards officers, the sexism, the racism that's been experienced. So there's no doubt there's individual wrongdoing. But it's also exposed something much bigger than that, which is a whole culture that kind of justifies and permits that wrongdoing.
The commissioner's pushed back on that, hasn't he? So he's avoided using the word institutionally. Yeah. What do you make of that, John? So his argument was, you know, that tars everybody in the Met in the same way. And of course there are, and we want to acknowledge that, there are good, I mean, we know Christians who are serving in the Met. There are good, honest police officers full of integrity. So is he right to do that? Is he right to push back on that institutional language?
Well, he has done, and the Police Federation has pushed back on that as well. So there's one narrative that would say the problem with the Met is some bad apples that need to be sort of dealt with. The other view is that actually the whole system is operating in a way that perpetuates.
Which is what the institutional language kind of points
Absolutely.
Towards, isn't it?
Yeah. And at one level, I think the Met sort of chief is an outlier in saying that virtually everybody else has accepted that this does reflect something of a systemic kind of culture. That was the judgment of the McPherson report. And I think we should remember that sort of McPherson was no kind of woke liberal. He was a kind of a high court judge, deeply analysing the way that the Met operated and the culture that it had. So it obviously is politically charged at the moment. And it's almost understandable why he wants to defend the police kind of in that way. But he is an outlier and he's been criticised for that. And I think we've seen the same issue, haven't we, in relation to churches where issues of kind of misuse of power have occurred within churches. That debate of whether or not it is purely some individuals who've behaved badly or whether there's something more systemically and culturally wrong is kind of an issue. And Christians have divided on that. Actually, it's bound up, as the Met chair said, this has become a politically loaded word because it does fit with what our culture is saying about what it means to be woke, and it can be misused in that way. I do think biblically there's a sort of, it's an important insight that sin operates not just at the personal level, but actually it does operate at a societal level. Yeah. So procedures, policies and approaches have the effect of causing harm to people, disadvantaging people, and sin becomes embedded within systems and the way that they operate. And actually the Bible would tell us that's the way that it is. If you look at the early chapters of Genesis, you have clearly on the one hand individual sin on the parts of people, but you have the degradation of society as a whole as sin begins to work its way through it.
Genesis 6, isn't it? That's exactly what happens.
Indeed. So sin generates kind of unjust structures that kind of cause harm to people. And I think from a holistic biblical perspective, and we shouldn't be afraid of recognizing that sin is both individual, but it also has corporate and collective and institutional elements in the way that it works out.
Lessons for us as a church then, Adrian?
Well, there are many, actually, and we could do several podcast episodes just on this, but two things that really leapt out to me. One is how their problems are especially present in elite units. So the firearms units, the diplomatic protection units, these are some of the units that the report authors looked at and found to be particularly, that the environment to be particularly sinister, malicious. And I think there is a lesson there that there is, when you start creating elite kind of leadership roles or elite kinds of service that are somehow better than others, you do run the risk of creating a kind of, you know, you can't touch me sort of atmosphere. And I think all of us who have, you know, we serve in the local church, but many pastors and the three of us around the room are in this position, serve in other ministries as well. There is a danger that we start to see ourselves as somehow beyond, you know, the ordinary calling of a pastor, which of course is the highest, I think is the highest calling of all. And when you start creating these sort of elite national, international roles, I think you have to be very, very careful. You have to work especially hard at accountability. Mm. You have to work especially hard at how you communicate and how you're represented. But because you're not just in your local church where there's accountability and friendship and love and relationship, you're operating in a world where some of those things are absent. Mm. And so I think there's something about you know, some of the roles that we create within evangelicalism, which are probably necessary to serve the church, but we need to be very careful how they're managed. I think that's one observation. I think the second observation is just that the Met is enormous. It has an enormous budget. I hadn't quite appreciated this. They were talking about the different divisions in the report and how a chief superintendent is in charge of an area of London. And the force under the chief superintendent will be larger than many other police services
across the country
with all the associated kind of support structures that go under them. And I think when churches get big, we need to be especially careful. The way essentially you have to run a large church is you have to work hard at organization. It necessarily becomes a bit more hierarchical. It's the only way to make it work. Mm. You know, if you're a church of 40, you can have a relationship with everybody. If you're a church of 400, you've got to think very differently about how that operates. And again, the danger is as we get larger and we get more distanced as senior leaders, especially from people, then the temptations to fall into sins, especially systemic sins, I think are greater. Mm. So it is interesting. There's no answer to that, I don't think, in the Met. And they're talking about perhaps breaking it up, but it's difficult to see how that might work in a place like London, where actually it is a whole. You know, how would neighbouring forces, all those sorts of questions, you know, are very, very difficult to resolve. But it does seem to me there's a problem of size that actually means the Met has been unable to heal itself. Mm. So you're right, John, to refer to the case of the McPherson report and the institutional racism, and it's interesting that nothing has been done. That's the kind of the accusation. I think things have been done, but not enough has been done. Mm. And I think that just goes to show that actually large organisations, they have a momentum of themselves. Mm. They're very, very difficult to sort of turn around, really. Mm.
Just to comment, I think in relation to the elite units, one of the things that flows out is the prioritisation of choosing where you put resources. So the report says that those units basically got everything they wanted, whatever gadgets, whatever equipment, they could have everything. Whereas, for example, the rape units or the domestic violence units were operating simply on a shoestring.
That's right.
And again, I think in ministry, we need to look at where do we put our resources? Do we kind of have some ministries that get everything, some ministries that are under-resourced? That tells you an awful lot about whether or not we're serving needs in an appropriate way. I think another observation is I think the report recognises that culture change takes a very long time. Mm. So it would be easy to come to this report and think there's an easy, simplistic solution. Whereas actually they say, for example, kind of raising the number of people from ethnic minorities serving in the Met, they think will take decades to achieve kind of something that reflects wider society. So there is a realism that cultural change doesn't happen overnight. And it kind of requires a sustained commitment to keep changing the culture. And again, I think that's helpful for us because in churches, again, we can think culture, we might identify a problem and think, oh, well, therefore it can be solved. But cultures take a very long time to be able to kind of be shifted and changed. And it requires sustained commitment to do that. And I think the failure after the McPherson report is that that obviously wasn't sustained.
Is there a parallel in Northern Ireland? You know, the RUC had a terrible reputation, didn't it? Historically, and I'm not saying it's that the Ulster Constabulary now is perfect, but actually there has been a change, hasn't there, in the way that the police service is seen in Northern Ireland over a a period of time.
And that required some significant changes.
It did.
External
people
brought in to kind of review it. The replacement of officers who didn't want to stay. Mm. So I think there were sort of officers who were basically paid to leave the service because they didn't want to work with the new culture. So it was costly to sort of, in a sense, retire and remove those who weren't willing to work with a new culture. And that's part of sustaining it. But even in Northern Ireland, I guess, the police service has to keep maintaining that new culture. It's not something that's ever done and fully finished. Again, the Bible would tell us that's the case. Sin constantly corrupts. You never deal with sin in the way that it's eliminated and it's removed. It requires a constant vigilance, a constant dealing, a constant repentance, a constant forgiveness. And I think we need to recognize that many of these things are not done. And leadership to do that. So one of the questions being raised is, can the current Met Chief lead that cultural change? But here, again, there's a lesson that sort of identity politics is not the answer. So the previous Met Commissioner was Cressida Dick, who was a woman and from the LGBTQ community. And at one level, you might think, well, people would think that would solve the problem. If you have somebody who's appointed who reflects certain of the groups who are being mistreated, surely that will mean the culture will change. But evidently it didn't. And her leadership has been.
And then, which comes back to size as well, doesn't it? Because she's a long, long way from the foot soldiers. You know, the distance between the top and the bottom of the organisational tree and the Met is enormous.
Another institution that's been in the news this week is Ofsted. This is the school's inspector. This follows the tragedy of the head teacher who took her own life while expecting an Ofsted report to be published that would downgrade her school, I think, from outstanding to inadequate dropping it down in that way. And that has led to a bit of a dam bursting amongst teachers, those who've been standing in solidarity with her. Some have talked about refusing entry to Ofsted inspectors. Others have taken the Ofsted logo from their letterheads. And there's been, it feels like a bit of a sea change in this last couple of weeks about this. First of all, what do we make of the Ofsted model? I mean, I experienced it at school and it just come in when I was at school. And it was fascinating to observe as a pupil. It just sounds like it's just got more and more onerous over the decades for teachers and schools. Am I overthinking that?
I don't think so. I mean, none of us are teachers.
No.
So it's difficult to comment on it from a sort of firsthand. I mean, you've seen it as a pupil, but it's difficult to know exactly the stress it causes for staff. And I think we all know staff. And head teachers in schools, it does cause an extraordinary amount of stress. And I think on, you know, I feel somewhat mixed about it because I think upholding standards in education is important. We do want our, you know, we do want our children, we've all got children, we do want children to be well educated in the state system. And we do want poor education to be called out and rooted out. You know, it's a different issue, I know, but not in a dissimilar way that we've been talking about. Met. We do want things that are substandard to be called out.
But is this the way to do it?
Well, it's difficult to know how to do it, Phil. So there's always there have been school inspections for 120 years, I think. Ofsted is a relatively recent invention in your lifetime.
Thank you.
You're a youngster. Those of us who are much older on this side of the table. But there have always been inspections. The difference is, I think it's become professionalised. Mm. So initially, when Ofsted was set up, actually, people were co-opted from other schools, head teachers who had retired, taken early retirement, or were actually employed by Ofsted to go and do inspections. In more recent years, professional organisations have had the work subcontracted to them. So I think there is an issue about, you know, trying to do it as cheaply as possible. And some of the motive behind that is by having a consistent, you know, consistent basis and all the rest of it. But actually, once you start having Ofsted inspectors, I think, who themselves are not teachers, or who have, it seems, in this particular situation, in other situations, we know certain agendas, then I think it does become worrying. So I do want there to be standards in schools, I think, and I do want schools to be called out and to measure up. But actually, any inspection that is based on, you know, a 24-hour visit or a 48-hour visit, is a little bit, it's always going to be odd, isn't it?
It's a snapshot in the life of the school, isn't it, John?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I can understand why government wants to be able to inspect and ensure that standards are maintained in kind of education. And your hearts go out to the kind of family of this teacher, head teacher who's killed herself. And actually, I would imagine also to the Ofsted inspectors. I can't imagine that they would have thought this would be the consequence of their inspection, and they've done their job. And I would imagine they feel awful about what the consequences of that have been. There's been a particular issue recently with... So outstanding schools haven't been inspected for quite a long time.
More than a decade in some cases, I think.
It does seem that Ofsted has adopted a policy of wanting to inspect outstanding schools and reduce their ratings in many cases. I think a fundamental problem with this whole process is not so much the inspection, but to reduce a verdict on a school to a single word. Mm. So that you can summarise the totality of what is happening by words that are kind of very strong, you know, outstanding or inadequate. I mean, if you hear the word inadequate, what do you think about a school? From what I've read, the main reasons for that was to do with some issues of record keeping and in relation to some aspects of sort of safeguarding issues.
There was a playground fight, wasn't there, when the inspectors were visiting.
Yeah. And you kind of think that is not then a verdict on the educational experience of most children who are there. So I think it's this reductionist way of describing a school in a single word. Whereas actually the inspection covers a whole variety of aspects of different life of the school. So I actually read the inspection report on my kids' school, and it covers everything from pastoral care to kind of the educational experience in the classroom, academic achievements, the governance structure of the school, kind of issues of safeguarding policy. So it's actually covering a vast range of the areas of activity of the school. And to try to summarise that in one word doesn't seem to necessarily be able to encapsulate
the especially a word
reality.
Like good, which is
and inadequate, which a parent might think may think means, well, what on earth are my children experiencing in the classroom? So you can understand why when you're labelled in that way, it's very difficult to respond to it. And I think there's a warning to us there about simplistic judgments.
Yeah.
I see this in Christian circles all the time. We might think about a church and people making a judgment about a church. And so often people talk about a sound church or a good church or whatever. And often that is a single word summary of a totality of things that are going on. And usually it's one aspect of a church that people have chosen to use to pass that verdict on. So I think we just need to recognise that actually that is often unfair. It's not fully accurate. It doesn't take into account all of the circumstances. Our judgments need to be much more nuanced than that. But actually people feel the pain of us labelling them in very simplistic terms. Mm.
And you can't judge a church on a one Sunday visit, can you?
No, you can't. And I think it would be very odd to go along to... I mean, I always think, when I was a pastor, I sort of get to the end of a service and think, oh, I hope there weren't any visitors here today. They probably won't come back. But no, I think you want to explore that more widely, don't you? You want to be thinking about, you know, what you're looking for in a church and recognise churches will be stronger at some things than they are at others. And that changes over time as well, depending on the leaders. And actually, you need to be thinking in the round, I would say, about church. And I mean, Labour have proposed that perhaps a report card would be a better approach. And maybe there's some merit in that. I wonder too, if in church life, it raises a question of self-evaluation. Now, I think leaders of churches should be spending time regularly looking at church life and evaluating it for themselves. And asking other people what they think and getting some input. You know, the kind of thing that you would hope inspectors are coming into schools to do. You would hope actually that good leaderships of organisations, whether that's a school, whether that's FIC, we do it, that we're actually asking questions about ourselves. How are we doing? What do people think of us? What are people saying about us that we need to hear and respond to? And we do that a lot. We have a termly retreat where we often ask those kinds of questions, and they're important questions to ask. And I think especially for church leadership, you should be asking those questions. You should be, not all the time. We don't want to be navel gazing. But I think we ought to be asking on a fairly regular basis, how are we doing as a church? How are we doing against the biblical criteria for what a church should be doing? Where are areas of weakness that we need to be honest about and we need to work on and pray through? Where are things that we can rejoice in? And very often, I think church leaders are either too optimistic and just rejoice in all the things that are good and aren't honest enough about the things that they struggle with. Or they're too pessimistic and they think everything's a disaster and needs improving. But actually, there are often things to rejoice at in church and to thank God for. And actually, that spirit of self-evaluation, it seems to me, is absolutely critical for church leadership.
I think it's worth saying, I think one of the big changes in society from 50 years ago is that then professionals were trusted to get on with their job. We now live in a culture in which kind of investigation, appraisal, assessment, kind of metrics are all part of the way that people are held to account. And that does create massive pressures on people in their jobs and in their work.
Same in the NHS, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think as church leaders, we need to really support the people in our congregations who are in those workplaces. That is the reality of where they spend much of their time and much of their life. And it is intensely pressured. Mm. It's both an opportunity to serve Christ, but there's also all these vulnerabilities that are there. And I think as churches, supporting and helping people as they experience those pressures is just a huge, huge part of what our pastoral ministry has to be.
Self-evaluation then, let's bring that back to the Commons.
And whether
our favourite partying Prime Minister did indeed mislead the Commons.
Oh, what's he been up to now?
So, as we know this week, he's come before a parliamentary committee. Boris. Did Boris Johnson mislead Parliament? So let's start there. John, yes
well,
or
he's,
no?
he says he did.
Yeah, but not so, intentionally.
Yeah, so
not intentionally.
I thought misleading... Well, we're getting into vocab.
We are. but I think there has been something fascinating about watching it this week because... It seems to me, this is my layman's observation, that here is a man who stood up before the nation every evening telling us what the COVID rules were, but now is seeming to say, well, they weren't particularly clear, so I'm not sure if I misled Parliament or not. Am I overthinking that?
It's ultimately for the judgment for the committee to make that decision. You've heard all the
evidence. Oh, come on, John, you can make a decision.
We can now reveal that John said before we went on air.
No, I didn't. What's striking to me is how people actually have already made up their mind in large measure. Mm. So actually there have been a whole load of people who are supporters of Boris who've said his performance in kind of Parliament in the committee, he's shown that there's no basis to this whatsoever. This is a kangaroo court and it ought to be dismissed and it's all part of a witch hunt. There's a whole load of other people who've taken exactly the opposite view and said, here is somebody who has patently lied and is providing very bad excuses for why they didn't really understand.
It's not going to change anyone's mind,
It's not. And actually, everybody will have to make up their own mind as to whether or not the evidence that he presented kind of is a real justification. It does seem really hard to believe that somebody who in that position of power, who knew what was happening in the country, who has advisors all around him, who is urging the country to, in a sense, avoid all social contact, stay at home, do nothing, where people were being fined up to £10,000 for organising a party of 30 people in their house, seems to sort of be a claim that they can be unaware of what was happening in their own kind of office and place. At the same time, I have a measure of sympathy. The kind of boundary line between what's work and what's not work wasn't clear in the guidance. Mm. And for those of us who were involved in trying to advise churches as to what it meant, again and again, actually it wasn't really very clear. And there were edges and there were fuzziness as to whether things fell within or not. The guidance was produced very rapidly and was constantly changing. Mm. And it did leave scope for kind of negotiation around those edges. So at one level, I also want to recognise actually in some of these things, the guidance was not crystal clear as to exactly where the boundary lines between sort of activities sort of fell.
That's very gracious.
It's very John. Measured, John. Thank you.
We're in that group. We had my father-in-law died during the COVID pandemic of ultimately of pancreatic cancer, which was his whole situation was exacerbated by catching COVID. We couldn't see him. Mm. And weren't allowed to go and see him. We had to say goodbye to him on a mobile phone. So it feels very. This feels very raw to me. I couldn't watch it actually because I just thought that the way that. So it seems to me this is a very personal observation. I don't mean this to be political, but the way that Boris kind of obfuscates and just sort of dodges questions and blusters and self-justifies, I personally find very difficult given the circumstances we went through. I just think that's very painful, and I think the lack of sympathy that there is towards those who did take a different view and did try and keep to rules and did try and do what was asked of them, I just think it's extraordinary. And a little bit more humility wouldn't go amiss, it seems to me.
It seems to miss the reality that there were lots of people who were finding this period hard. So it's saying, you know, it was hard for us trying to make the decision. Well, it was hard for NHS workers. Yeah. It was hard for teachers. It was hard for parents. It was hard for everybody in different ways.
And we did learn how to do things on Zoom. And, the argument that 10 Downing Street is an old townhouse and people kind of brushing up against one another. Well, most things we learned how to do remotely. We didn't need to be in the same place. So I just think there's some, to me, there are some big unanswered questions.
What leadership lessons are there, John?
Well, I think you have to lead with integrity. And there needs to be a commitment to a kind of honesty. I mean, at one level, politicians twist the truth, defend themselves, spin. That's become part and parcel of political culture for some period of time. I mean, you can see this week that the debates have been going on about the whole kind of Northern Ireland protocol, a kind of agreement, and the Windsor kind of framework that's been adopted. I've been astonished at reading politicians basically saying the Brexit deal that was negotiated, we only did it because we had to, and it was always the intention to renegotiate it. We never had any real intention of kind of keeping the Northern Ireland protocol we negotiated. You kind of think, is that really the case? That wasn't what was being said at the time. Here was an oven-ready deal that was kind of being introduced. So this kind of spinning and not saying what you mean and not quite telling the truth and weaseling out of responsibility has become, unfortunately, part and parcel of our political culture.
Is that a problem for church leaders, that kind of spinning?
Yeah, absolutely.
Give us a for instance.
I think, for example, leaders can easily overstate their size, their implications. They big up their membership numbers. They talk about themselves positively in that way. Sometimes the way that they can speak about others can be a little bit like sort of Prime Minister's Question Time. We kind of big ourselves up by running kind of others kind of down. When they're confronted and challenged, they tend to defend and explain and excuse rather than simply accept that maybe it was a mistake and to put that right. I think partly that is vulnerability. I guess the reason why politicians behave like this is their job is on the line. Boris Johnson's political career is on the line, his potential position in the kind of constituency and whether there's a recall is on the line, and people under pressure defend themselves because they are fearful. And actually that's, again, a natural human sinful reaction. And we don't actually live in a culture that has a great deal of grace, actually, in relation to people who are making incredibly difficult decisions, and sometimes they get it wrong. And there's a difference between do they do that mendaciously or do they do that kind of because they're not as competent or because they're caught by the pressures of the moment. So we can be actually very judgmental, and that judgmentalism actually creates a culture in which people obfuscate about what's
happening. And there is a place for transparency too, isn't there? I think what's become clear now as we start to look at, you know, the WhatsApp messages from Hancock and various other people is politicians were saying things in public with absolute certainty that they were very unsure of. Now, obviously, they had to set public policy and they had to think wisely about how they did that. But I think there is this is part of integrity, isn't it? To actually appear to be very certain about things that you're not certain about in private. I think in church leadership, we have to be transparent. If there are questions we don't know the answer to, we have to say, I don't know.
Yeah.
And I think that sort of humility is often lacking in the world in general. And that cashes out in church life.
And I think church leaders actually can, in their teaching and their preaching, can do that all the time. They actually speak things with a degree of certainty that aren't quite justified. And I think for all of us, there are levels of theological conviction about what we think is taught and right. Yeah. Some of the things we hold with absolute certainty. Others, we might have a lesser degree of certainty about them. So we might have very clear certainty about the nature of the atonement and the death of Christ, slightly less certainty about actually what the right mode of baptism is. But so often we can speak with a conviction that we are absolutely certain. And sometimes actually we would serve our congregations better by recognising that.
Yes, and actually we make partnership very difficult. We're just doing our local conferences at the moment on partnership. There's a good podcast with Gavin Orland you might like to catch up with. And actually if we attach too much certainty to too many things that actually the Bible doesn't allow us to be absolutely certain about, we make partnership very difficult. It's not just within the congregation. It's how we work with another congregation down the road. That becomes almost impossible unless you share every, you know, jot and tittle of every doctrine.
Last couple of minutes, let's talk about the final of The Apprentice, which has taken place this week. Adrian wanted to talk about this. All I can say, without any spoiler alert at all, the winner was female. But enough of my teasing. Adrian, what did you want to say about this?
I have to confess, I don't watch The Apprentice. I find it rather tiresome. Got some family connections going back with Lord Sugar, and I find it all a bit contrived.
Well, that's another. I'll make a note of that.
I think it's important to remember it's an entertainment show, right? It's not a business show. I think initially when it started off, it did start off more as a budding entrepreneurs, but clearly they're selecting candidates now on the basis of who can be
good telly,
yeah. And that means they're often, these people who were presenting business plans. I saw the interviews round. I happened to be reading a book and it was on, my wife and daughter watching it, and I couldn't avoid it really. And it was extraordinary just to see how ill judged and just how not really very well formed the business plans were, you know, just in the real basics. But I think the thing that really struck me about it is that the people who were doing the interviews were almost wholly without exception, extraordinarily rude. Mm. Yeah, very aggressive. I mean, you would almost use the word abusive in some, you know, they're making people cry. And I, it just seems to me that there is a kind of model of leadership that is being in an, I know it's entertainment, don't write in, but it's a kind of model of leadership that's being put forward, which actually doesn't bear a lot of relation to the real world. I mean, I've worked in business, and people who get to be senior leaders of organizations tend not to be like that. Entrepreneurs are slightly different, you know, sort of the go-getters of this world. But I mean, I sat in a meeting with, you know, spoiler alert, I sat in a meeting with Richard Branson and talking about tax. It was very dull. Don't worry, it was very dull. And he's not like that either. So you just sort of think this sort of aggressive, punchy, you know, what about you? That sort of stuff. That's not leadership. And I think we've got to be careful that we don't take that on as a model and think, you know, oh, well, that's great. That's the, you know, to, the way to interrogate things is to really go for people and really sort of pick holes in stuff. You know, the Christian leadership is modeled on Christ and his servant-heartedness, his gentleness. And you can be the guy who mentored me for 9 years, died a couple of weeks ago, Eric Lane, in his 90s, great pastor. Very, very, very grateful to God for him. He was tenacious, Eric, tiny guy, very short, but he was tenacious, but he was extraordinarily gentle. And I think we mustn't confuse the two. So you can hold on to things very firmly, and you can have strong opinions about things. You can pursue things very vigorously. You can be tenacious, and you can still be gentle. Mm. And that, it seems to me, is just blown apart by The Apprentice as a model of leadership. We've got to reject that.
We have watched it. My kids watch it, and it's one of the things we can do together as a kind of family. But at one level, I think it reveals, particularly over the development of The Apprentice, the corrupting effect of entertainment, actually. Mm. I think that it did start out with people who were actually competent in business, who were performing tasks that were more business-orientated. And I think it's just become another reality television program. Yeah. And actually, all reality television effectively functions like a pantomime. in that people are set up to appear ridiculous. That's what gets the audience in. Everybody becomes a cliche. I mean, it's you know, it's a sort of scripted outworking, and it's actually there that everybody can effectively laugh at it and laugh at the candidates. And I think that is actually what entertainment does to a lot of things. Actually, that is what entertainment does to Christianity when entertainment becomes the focus of the church and the way the church operates. Way of teaching, the way of leadership, the way that we treat one another. If we think the purpose is primarily to entertain, then it will end up being debased.
Yes.
And I think that's what's happened in The Apprentice. And it seems to me that it's a tired format that basically ought to end. But I think the lesson for us is actually if we buy into that reality television kind of culture, and that is feeding into the way that we think we ought to be doing church, the way our services ought to be being run, the way that we ought to be preaching, in the end, we will be debasing something precious and significant.
Baroness Brady, who's part of it, one of the contestants called her Karen by mistake, probably because off camera they are calling her Karen.
Yeah.
And she looked at her steely-eyed and said, "That's Baroness Brady to you." Which actually is incorrect. You don't address a baroness as Baroness Brady, and Baroness Brady should know that. So I think I'll write in, and public service broadcasting, Phil, in the news, FIC, how to address a lord appropriately.
Right. Well, maybe so it should be Lord Sugar, you're retired, should be there. The next line, maybe. Brothers, thanks for talking about the news this week. This has been Independence, the FIC podcast. Do rate, leave a review, and we'll speak to you again very soon. Thanks for listening.
Thanks.